Let's talk about the Secret Service. This is a book by Carol Leonig called Zero Fail. And Carol Leonig is a reporter for the Washington Post and put together this book that is very well researched, has details in it that I have read in other books and other places, and also pulls from her own reporting, and I'm sure the reporting of her teammates and colleagues across the spectrum of journalistic publications, including the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. The book, however, seems like it might be straining a little bit to make a point that a lot of government agencies try to make, and I think falls a little bit on some deaf ears from time to time. So let's talk about this book today, Zero Fail by Carol Leonig. But before we get to that, I want to take a quick moment to thank those of you who have downloaded and have been listening to this podcast so far. I have no idea who you are, but thank you for being here. If you would, and you're like, you know what, I would really like to do something nice for Justin, give a little comment or something, preferably a good one, in the iTunes store. It really helps people find the show and makes us a little bit more worth doing. For my part, I've actually enjoyed doing this for the simple fact that it makes my own thoughts about things a little clearer and sort of solidifies my thinking. I tend to be a slow thinker about a lot of things. Most of these books that I read, I finish them and then I sit down and I start, you know, start recording a show about them, usually in about a day or two, but sometimes it can be as much as a week. I actually finished this book that we're talking about today by Carol Leonig. Last week, this was a book that I had purchased on Audible through my subscription there. And the narration on it is actually excellent. And there's two narrators on it. And it's not uncommon for the author of the book to narrate the introduction. Carol also narrated the end of the book, the last couple of chapters, I assume, because the book kind of either came out or she wanted to add more to it at the end. And so for production reasons or something to that effect, there just wasn't enough time for the professional voiceover recorder to do it. I don't know. But at any rate, she narrates the first chapter and then Meg Reed narrates the bulk of the book. And then the last two chapters, which broadly covers the Trump administration from Trump's inauguration until the book comes out, which was released, it was released in May of 2021. So I assume that the end of the book is really someplace around the end of 2020. And they both do an excellent job, but I really wanted to call out the fact that Maggie Meg Reed does excellent work on this. I've not listened to a lot of books that have strong female narration. In fact, there really aren't a lot of female narrators for a lot of books that, at least that I've come across. It's not that I don't go seeking them out one way or the other. And I haven't seen numbers, but I just kind of have to assume that there aren't as many female narrators on audiobooks for all the reasons that we think there aren't, sadly. And I don't know if that's because people seem to think that more folks want to listen to the dulcet tones of a man speaking or not. I have no idea. But for whatever reason, Maggie Meg Reed did an excellent job at this and made it seem very powerful and strong, and it was an excellent bit of narration. So now that we've got that out of the way, let's talk about how this book is set up. This book is set up largely chronological. There were some comments that I read from other reviews around the web. People were complaining about how it sort of bounced around from one place to another. I didn't really find that to be a problem. The book starts off broadly with the Kennedy assassination. And picks up in the 60s. There's a little bit of a brief overview sort of interspersed in there as they talk about, you know, sort of the formation of the Secret Service and, you know, presidential assassinations, particularly Garfield, McKinley, and Lincoln, of course, and sort of where the Secret Service fit in relation to that and how it was formed and sort of the country's overall pulse on not wanting to sort of envelop the president in a bubble and sort of being allergic to this idea that we would have something like the Secret Service. And so It was set up well. It follows the action very well. And one of the things that I found really interesting about this book is the fact that one of the first books that I read several years ago that really got me interested into reading was a book called Five Presidents by Clint Hill. And Clint Hill is probably not a name that you recognize, but Clint Hill is absolutely a person that you recognize. on the day of the Kennedy assassination, the photos of Jackie and President Kennedy in the back of that sedan are striking and ever present. And there's the one photo of a Secret Service agent who's sort of crawling over the hood of the car towards the back and is reaching for Mrs. Kennedy. The guy on the trunk of the, or maybe it's the trunk of the car, actually, not the hood, but the guy on the trunk of the car is Clint Hill. It was a Secret Service agent who was there the day that Kennedy was shot. He saw the whole thing happen. He wrote a book about his time during five presidencies. He served briefly with Eisenhower before then being on Kennedy's detail. And then I think eventually left during the Reagan administration. Clint Hill, I'm sure he didn't actually write his book. I'm sure it was ghostwritten or at least heavily edited in some fashion. But it's the one book that really got me interested in reading a lot of political nonfiction stuff. And Zero Fail sort of picks up some of the elements that Clint Hill touches on and some of the stuff that it doesn't. And some of the stuff that it doesn't are some of the things that make sense as to why he wouldn't have. There is a lot of consternation built around the idea that Kennedy's detail was drunk, or at least that they were drinking heavily the night before, and that, as a scandal goes, most of the men who were there the day of Kennedy's assassination probably weren't in the best physical shape, at least maybe not the best mental shape, to be doing their jobs. After the Kennedy assassination, a lot of the agents on that detail were naturally very sort of depressed and morose about their failure. They felt it very personally. They actually all liked John F. Kennedy a lot. Carol's book goes into some depth about what it was like for the agents in the Kennedy administration. It is exactly what you think it is, which is that John F. Kennedy had sort of an insatiable appetite for sex with all sorts of women. The Secret Service, interestingly, which I did not know from the prior book by Clint Hill, they were very concerned that the president could be put in danger by a woman. In fact, they actually thought the best way, if you wanted to kill the president, the best way to do it was to just walk in the White House wearing a nice skirt and some high heels and be pretty. Because the notion being that the Soviets could have sent any woman into the White House, and it probably would have attracted the attention of President Kennedy, and they probably would have sequestered them away alone for a while. And there was significant concern amongst the Secret Service that Kennedy could be compromised through blackmail, or that he could just straight up be murdered, that somebody could just walk in there and have a knife or strangle him or do any number of other things to murder the president. But they all knew their role in those circumstances was to really, you know, protect the president and protect his independence to be able to do that, I guess, if the, for lack of a better word, his independence, I suppose. After the Kennedy assassination, the book moves on afterwards into what it was like for the agents recovering from the assassination. She talks a lot in here, too, about sort of the command structure of the Secret Service. One thing that I didn't know that I've learned from this is, after she's interviewed hundreds of people for this book, she's sorted through thousands of documents and investigation files from probably the last 50, 60, 70 years. And through it all, they're amassed a growing body of research that suggested that the Secret Service is arguably the worst place in the federal government to work. That as an agency, the morale is the lowest within the Secret Service. The agents who work within the Secret Service, and that's not just the ones that have the suits and the earpieces within the presidential protective detail, but that's also the ones who are on, you know, counterstrike teams, counterterrorism teams, assessment teams, the folks who go to the advanced locations to scout out security threats and so forth, that by and large, the Secret Service is a miserly, miserable place to work within the federal government. And part of that, as she, I think, tries to make the argument for, is due in no small part to the fact that the Secret Service has almost a rigid tradition about everything. It's certainly, for probably the majority of its entirety up until about the Obama administration, very much a good old boys club. The directors have always been chosen based off of two arguably somewhat terrible reasons. Directors for the Secret Service are almost always chosen based off of who is sort of next up in line, just sort of through the ascension of rank. And also the president picks that person to be their protective. They pick the person who's on the protective detail, but they also pick the person who is the director. And usually that boils down to just whoever they find to be the most comfortable with. And that has almost never worked for any president at all in terms of being good for the service. It's usually been pretty good for the president because they have a trusting relationship with the person and it makes them feel comfortable, which shouldn't be discounted, I suppose. But as many topics in this book show, that doesn't do well for the book, or at least, it doesn't do well for the service. As she goes through sort of the assassination attempts on Reagan, there are assassination attempts on Gerald Ford. There are assassination attempts on other world leaders. There are political scandals against the Secret Service, particularly sort of in that George, after the George W. Bush administration, Obama and Trump was just mired in Secret Service scandals. Because the service was primarily all men. And as the author explains, they were in peak physical condition. They're usually young men, and they usually work very hard, and they play very hard. And so when they go out to places, particularly in other countries, they end up getting smashing drunk. They often pay for prostitutes. This was what happened during the Obama administration, and it ends up being terrible for everybody involved. I feel like, however, I feel like this book is as if you were to wake up one morning and decided that you were going to make a list of all the things that you needed to improve in your life. And you were going to also make a list of all the things that you wanted to fix in your house. And then you added up how much money that would take, right? And of course, anybody would sit down and start making all sorts of requests, right? Like you might say that I'm going to exercise better or eat better. I'm going to fix the leaking sink a little bit, or I'm going to fix that dent in the siding. You're going to find all sorts of, if you really had to go through and you sort of made almost a wish list of what it is that you wanted, what you wanted to do and how it would change your life, how it would change your home, you would come up with a pretty big list. And if you actually sat down and said, okay, now how do I pay for it? Your list gets much smaller. And if you recognize, you know, what will I realistically be able to do? What will I realistically be able to pay for? And what will I realistically be able to accomplish with the maximum sort of investment and return on investment and value for what it is that I'm trying to do? Your list would be a lot shorter. And of course, everything can always be better, and everything can always be a little bit more improved. And the Secret Service and government agencies are no exception to that. And so I'm not really sure if she's trying to make claims somehow that the Secret Service is there to protect democracy itself through the symbolism and the actual protection of the leaders that they are charged with protecting. But she also argues that somehow the president represents democracy, but the presidency is larger than one man. And democracy is larger than one man. And so this book is, I think, trying to have it both ways a little bit. That is my quibble with this book. I think it's very well written. I think it's easy to read. I think it's understandable. I think it tells pretty gripping stories, actually. I really can't do them justice because the stories have so much backstory and detail, because it just, the characters in the service or in the book too, they have such long tenures sometimes, and that the agents that are in there, you know, they start as juniors and they sort of work their way up, and for the rank and file to then move up, you know, there's the bureaucracy that happens within any sort of bureaucracy, because it is literally a bureaucracy. And the result of it is a rich tapestry of individuals who I think by and large are all patriots. I think they care about the work that they are doing, but they are also human. And they are also law enforcement officers. And she goes into some depth to talk about how the Secret Service, by and large, is Republican. It's a pretty conservative organization. It's filled with largely conservative people because they come from law enforcement. And law enforcement either tends to attract or convert people into being slightly more conservative than the average. And as a result, the people that are in there sort of have different feelings about different presidents. But in the ways that she sometimes also tries to have it both ways in this book, there's the notions of like Kennedy, for example. Kennedy was very well liked, very well respected. So was Gerald Ford. You know, oddly missing in this whole book was the Carter administration. It just doesn't seem to be a whole lot in there about Jimmy Carter at all, which was a little strange. In fact, I kept wondering, like, where's Jimmy Carter in this? And how did people not have any opinions about that? And it's probably because there wasn't really a whole lot happening in the Carter administration, that Jimmy Carter himself was really above reproach on a lot of things. His character was very good. I think that he probably he had the reputation, at least, of appointing a lot of people who were similar to him in that regard, that his cabinet and his leaders and his directors and his agency heads and probably even his protective detail were all a bunch of Boy Scouts. And there probably wasn't that much to report there. And that really got glossed over. And so I'm not really sure why that is. If she were sitting here right now, I'd ask her why there wasn't a whole lot from the Carter administration to talk about in that. But there wasn't. There's also something interesting in here about some of the history of the Secret Service. The FBI and the Secret Service are, as she explains in this book, and I tend to take it at its value, not friendly towards one another. I think they're friendly insofar as that if there's a job to do, they will do their job or whatever. But there's some competition there, right? There's competition for talent. There's competition for resources and that sort of thing. But apparently, and I did not know this despite having read lots of things about the history surrounding Theodore Roosevelt, but in 1908, there were several profiteering scandals involving Western land and Western land grants that involved senators and congressmen. And you know, as things were at the time, there was no federal investigative authority in things. The closest was the Secret Service, which had been charged originally from the Treasury Department to protect America's money. And how the service kind of grew into a protective detail that also focused on securing the nation's money. There's some discussion about that in the book, but largely it involves the Civil War and changes in how, you know, the country's mood and demeanor about what it is worth protecting and what isn't, and why we protect the president and why we don't. At any rate, during these profiteering scandals in the early 20th century, Congress started to meddle in the investigation. And the Secret Service at the time was the only investigative body that was involved, because it was the only one the federal government had. And Congress started to meddle in this because they were afraid, probably for their skins, that they were going to get caught up in some of the profiteering that they had also enjoyed. Theodore Roosevelt got mad that they were meddling in a federal investigation, and he transferred 8 Secret Service agents into a secret unit and charged them with the task of investigating these profiteering scandals and Western land grants and other issues. Those 8 agents that ran that secret unit became the precursor to what we now know as the FBI. And so the irony of ironies in all of this is that the FBI wouldn't exist if not for the Secret Service. It also wouldn't exist if not for the Secret Service trying to do their jobs, but that Congress was meddling in the investigation of themselves. And so, like lots of things that date back to Theodore Roosevelt, this is one of those, oh, that's how that came to be. At any rate, the service as an agency has all sorts of mission growth over the years that have caused them to both struggle with hiring, struggle with their financials, struggle with their technology, and struggle with their culture. And the service, I think, maintains, and I think the argument comes across in the book fairly, the service maintains that it needs money to be able to do all these things. And as a budget within what is now the Department of Homeland Security, it's pretty dang small. And there's lots of things that are still tradition that still don't make any sense, including giving the Secretary of the Treasury Secret Service protection, which has always been part of its charge back when it was part of the Treasury Department because it was investigating the nation's money and counterfeit dollar bills. This tried to change under the Trump administration, but then Secretary of the Treasury Steven Mnuchin got miffed at the idea, did not like the idea of not having Secret Service protection. And so for all things Trumpy, it just never changed in the way that we probably thought made sense. And so they continued to spend money on those sorts of things. She talks a lot in here too about hiring and the hiring problems and hiring practices of the service that for most of its history up until about 2010 during the Obama administration, have always resulted in largely white men at the top, increasingly some black agents in the rank and file. But during a scandal involving some prostitution, and there were DUI issues during the Obama administration with some of the advance teams working in places both domestically and abroad, at one point, Barack Obama says the problem with the Secret Service is that you don't have enough women in your ranks, and particularly in your leadership. And that begat a scenario where the Secret Service tried to adjust how they do their hiring, and they actually threw out something like 300 agents that were sort of in the pipeline, which was a very manual pipeline. Leonig makes the case that the technology that the Secret Service was using was far behind the rest of the federal government. And so they decided to throw out their applications and start afresh. And that resulted in them placing job ads for Secret Service agents on USA Jobs, the website that the rest of the federal government used. However, the problem there became that the Secret Service was inundated with over 30,000 applications, mostly from people who had no business applying for positions within the Secret Service, either because they couldn't pass the qualifications. They either had no idea what they were applying for. They didn't know what the Secret Service was doing or what they would do. And in some cases, they had people who had previous records, other security clearance problems. And in one circumstance, a 400-pound man who did not realize that maybe he shouldn't be 400 pounds to be on the Secret Service roster. And so they actually wasted a lot of time during that process and then had to throw it all out again. Out of the 30,000 applications, I think they hired about 18 individuals from that, not any more or less diverse than was already the situation for them. And so they had to sort of reconfigure a lot of their hiring again in order to be able to start attracting talent. It really wasn't until the end of the Obama administration that they sort of started to get those things cleared out. What is clear from this book, the clearest thing is that whoever is in the director's seat at the Secret Service has a thankless job. Whether they're there on good merits or not, they are usually the first person to get ejected at the slightest whiff of a scandal or a problem, of which there have been many at the Secret Service. My favorite situation that I had never heard about throughout all of this is a situation that involved Barack Obama's daughters and his mother-in-law, that apparently at some point around 2010 or maybe 2011, Barack Obama and Michelle Obama were on a carrier jet, an aircraft carrier in San Diego. They were inbound to Hawaii, stopped off in San Diego to watch what was then the first professional NBA game on an aircraft carrier. While they were there, their two daughters, Sasha and Malia, were at the White House, and their mother-in-law, Michelle Obama's mother, was also at the White House. Somebody had rolled up near the South Lawn of the White House, pushed a small weapon out of the side of their car, and fired something like 7 or 8 shots at the White House. Many of those shots hit the White House. They were lodged. They found bullets lodged in the glass. They found bullets lodged in the window frames and the wooden seals. And one of the Secret Service agents who was in sort of a watch out post was so sure that it was gunshots, because not only did she hear it, and that most of the agents were very well attuned to understand what a gunshot sounded like, that part of the White House itself, part of the cement and plaster of the building, was hit and fell on her, like near her where she was standing. This all happened at night, however, and so there wasn't very clear direction about where the gunshots were coming from. But in the melee, in the chaos of trying to figure it all out, their call came over the radio from a supervisor to stand down, and that it wasn't anything more than some construction equipment that was nearby that had backfired. This was not true and was so untrue that some of the agents were so aghast by it that they kind of kept searching for a little bit until eventually their orders to stand down were so firm that they eventually went back to their posts. The problem was that somebody actually did shoot at the White House, and civilians outside the White House saw it and were even tweeting about it from the back of cabs and Ubers and on the sidewalk. There was a neurosurgeon, for instance, who reported this. And once the guy had shot at the White House, he drove off at a high rate of speed, ended up getting in a wreck near the Roosevelt Bridge, and then ran off on foot. By the time a police officer had come up on the car was already empty, and the investigation was turned over to the U.S. Park Police, since it was their jurisdiction from wherever the car was found. This guy who fired at the White House was mentally ill and going through a schizophrenic break, was later picked up briefly by troopers in Virginia who let him go because they didn't know anything more. They just thought he was a guy who seemed a little deranged, but he hadn't done really anything illegal. There wasn't any laws broken, and so they let him go. Long story short, throughout this investigation, there was a lot of cover-up from the higher-ups who were trying to diminish this as a failure, which it absolutely was. And at one point, it wasn't until Michelle Obama came back from the trip and heard from an usher about what had happened that she went ballistic. And apparently, people within the White House remembered that they could remember hearing her through several closed doors in the Oval Office yelling at the Secret Service agents who were in charge at the time, because she could not understand how they wouldn't even tell her that her detail hadn't even told her, even when they were off in San Diego. And this was just sort of one of the kinds of stories that gets interwoven throughout this book. I think it is incredibly fascinating. It, you know, over the last 60 years, the service has grown from 300 agents to about 3,000 agents now. It follows the politics, particularly within the Trump administration, and how they sort of use the Secret Service as a sort of an investigative arm to sort of investigate some of their enemies and some of their political adversaries, and to try and protect the president. Also about how the Secret Service was used to enrich the Trump administration because of the sheer amount of travel that they were doing, and how they split the service up so thinly between New York, his various golf courses in the White House, that some Secret Service agents were taking advanced or distant members of the Trump family around town in their own private vehicles because they had no government vehicles available to them in order to be able to do their jobs. I think the conclusion of this book is that the Secret Service is an agency that has been in turmoil, that it continues to be in turmoil, that it has severe lack of leadership, and it has a severe lack of cultural empathy within it. It lacks diversity at the top that could help tamper down some of these problems, particularly some of the basically what amounts to what I assume is just bro culture of drinking and prostitution and sex and hard partying and hard work, right? And I think that if she were sitting here right now, she would make the argument that the Secret Service deserves extra attention because of the very public-ish role that they play in our democracy and the very important job that they have and how incredibly challenging that job is. There are moments in this book where they describe how even during drills where the Secret Service would be training sort of at a rope line scenario, trying to protect someone who's, you know, shaking hands with people around fences and things, and that even when they've been told who to look for, that they actually know the suspect, they know that the actual person who is going to try to pop off a shot at the person that they are protecting, they still fail to protect the president, you know, in this training situation every time. Because it is almost impossible for a person to react swiftly and quickly enough against a person who has somehow managed to get a gun into an event. And you're like, how often does a gun actually get into an event, Justin? And it's like, well, according to Leonic, quite a bit. In fact, there was at one point a veteran who climbed over the fence during the Obama administration managed to evade dozens of highly trained Secret Service agents who did not notice him. It was dark. Did not notice him in the shadows. The technology sensors were either broken or had been turned off because they were so frequently false alarms that they actually became to annoy the ushers, and they became a sore point within the service because they were always responding to false alarms and it was exposing other perimeters around the White House. And this guy managed to walk up over the course of 15 minutes across the White House grounds, into the White House and into the green room before anybody even noticed him. And everything that could go wrong in those situations did go wrong. Those sorts of situations happened more times than you even knew happened, more times than I even recall at any of those points, even though they apparently made the news. I don't remember those events. There were similar situations with Michelle Obama and her hotel rooms. There was a situation similarly during the Clinton administration with protective failures there. These sorts of things have always been part of the job, and we expect a certain amount of failure on these things. I'm sure the Secret Service would say that, like the CIA, their failures are often very public and their successes are usually not, or almost always go unnoticed. I think that this book, Zero Fail by Carol Leonig, takes a pretty even-handed approach to the problems. I just don't know that there's a solution to them. I don't know that money is necessarily the solution to all of these problems. I'm sure they probably could use more money, just like you could probably use more money for your house. I know I could use more money for my house. But I don't know that if you just sort of dumped a bunch of money in here, would it fix every problem, or would it just sort of beget different kinds of problems because you would replace something? You'd replace one piece of faulty technology with a newfangled piece of technology that may or may not work any better or worse than what you already replaced, right? Because a lot of these things, like sensors, are still very fickle and nascent and cumbersome, right? So I don't know. If the Secret Service is listening and you would like to make a response, by all means, send me an email. You can write podcast@justinharder.com and I'll respond and we'll set up a time to chat. And if the author, Carol Leonig, is out there listening and you'd like to reach out and make a response or a statement, email me, podcast@justinharder.com. And you can too, if you'd like. You can also follow me on Twitter @JLHarder. I don't publish there as much as I used to, but I occasionally do. I'm trying to be more regular about my production of work on my main website at justinharder.com and through this podcast. Zero Fail by Carol Leonig. Okay book. Not really sure what I'm supposed to do with the information. It's very informative. I think you'll like this book if you like books that are sort of dark, tense, a little reflective, somewhat fast-paced, I think. I think it's largely a medium-paced book, but pretty quick in spots. The audible narration, if you're interested in the audiobook, is very good. I don't know that I care so much for the author's narration of it, but I give her credit for doing it. It's not an easy thing to do, I know, because I'm not that good at this podcast, but here I am. So good for her for making that effort. I think the primary reader of the book, Maggie Meg Reed, did an excellent job on the audiobook version. And overall, I give her performance 4 stars, and I think that the book overall is 3 stars.